insurance company's problem. That's all, it's a different process of risk sharing. This is peculiar to this nature of risk financing, and it is critically important.
Other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we go to Dick Block. Mr. Block, wish to testify? Morning, sir. State your name, please, and affiliation.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you very much. For purposes of the record, my name is Richard Block. I am here for the firm of Block & Associates, but I'm actually, and my firm are here on behalf of a domestic insurance company that is the primary writer of workers' compensation in the state of Alaska, Alaska National Insurance Company. Perhaps it might be useful, some of the people around the table will recall that I've been in Juneau and around this table many times before and know a little of my background, but for the benefit of those that don't know me as well, I bring a certain amount of experiential background in this field that may be of value for you to know about. I have been involved in the insurance industry since about 1968, so that's about 30 years, as an attorney, as a general counsel, as an assistant general counsel, and as an administrative officer for an insurance company, a large national insurance company that was primarily responsible for writing workers' compensation. I came to Alaska in 1975, and my primary role here at that time was to counsel the state government on dealing with workers' compensation issues and also to deal with medical malpractice issues, and that's relevant to this discussion because what the state did at that time was form a response, form a legislative response to what was then a very serious problem. I was then asked to become the director of the Division of Insurance, which position I held for 3 years here in Juneau, and after leaving that position, formed a consulting firm, which I still operate and which is still providing counsel to large risks, governmental and private, and including on issues very similar to this, and that is how can I, as an individual, or we as a group, or as an association of governmental entities, reduce our cost of workers' compensation insurance through some imaginative alternative insurance mechanism to the standard insurance company mechanisms. And then also was responsible for the formation of Alaska National, which is now one of the larger writers in the state, and was its president for 6 years. And so I do have a great deal of familiarity with this issue, great deal of familiarity with the industry, great deal of familiarity with the problem which I believe the home builders seek to solve, and a familiarity with how alternative mechanisms work. But I also think I have some local knowledge about the marketplace in this state and what would be satisfactory here and elsewhere. It's been a little bit frustrating for me and for the people that I speak for to see this bill move along as deliberately as it has in the face of some very specific information that's been provided to the various committees over the time that this has been passing through the legislature that has come from people opposed to the bill that have pointed out why there are serious problems with it and has documented that in footnoted testimony and so forth. And also a little frustrating to see that even though there's been very substantial opposition from the two most cognizant state divisions, that this bill keeps moving along. Let me explain if I can. It must be a failure on my part or on the part of those that are trying to point out the problem to adequately demonstrate really what the fundamental problem is. And it is not the amount of premium that it's going to write, and it is not all the backup financial underpinnings that they keep tacking onto it. There's a fundamental thing that has not been addressed. And perhaps I might explain what it is I'm driving at by asking you to join me in a little imaginative experiment, and that is to ask each of you to assume that you would like to form jointly around this table some form of business enterprise. You have done a feasibility study and a business report and have determined that because of the front-end costs, because of the risks involved, because of the nature of your business, because of how long it's going to take to build up to a break-even point, that you're going to need an underlying capital base of $1 million. Now, the way a normal private enterprise would go about that is they would in some way form an enterprise, maybe a corporation, and they would raise $1 million before they would start, before they would sell one unit of product or service. So you decide among yourselves that each of you would like to participate, and you say, I have a certain amount of net worth, and you say, I have a certain amount of net worth, and I'm willing to make a contribution. But your net worth is made up out of land that you own someplace, and yours is fine art objects, and someone else's is made up of pickup trucks and tools and equipment. And so you say, I don't have the cash to actually put in, but I'll take my proportionate share of stock, and what I will give you in lieu of that, what I will give you in exchange from that, for that, is a promise. A promise that if anything goes wrong in this corporation, you can come and get money from me and I'll help you pay the deficit between the earnings or the revenue stream and the expenses that we've incurred. Now, I ask you, from an accounting standpoint, if what you do is you issue the stock in exchange for this promise, what is the net worth of the corporation? If you exchange the stock for these letters of promise, is the net worth the combined net worth of all of you, as you promised it to be? Or is it the combined net worth of your liquidation value when you sell your pickup trucks or your art or your tools? Or is the net worth what we argue that it is, that in fact it's zero, even though these promises are sitting out there? Now, the problem that we've tried to present here is that the proponents of this bill are attempting to establish an incredibly risky enterprise with no capital contribution. And their argument is it doesn't matter because we have all of these other things in place. We're looking for the $1 million premium, 25% of which will be paid up front. We are looking for reinsurance. We are looking for a guarantee fund. We're looking for bonds. But the fact is that you start out with nothing in the till. And workers' compensation is probably the most risky of all businesses in the insurance industry to undertake because of the long tail, because of the exposures, because of the potential for catastrophic losses. And that is the gravamen of our concern. Now, Senator Adams has asked several times, what is the impact of increasing the minimum premium requirement from $500,000 to $1 million? And interestingly enough, the answers that have come are, one, it really doesn't matter, and that the increase in $1 million is simply a reflective of increased exposure. And therein lies the problem. It's like saying, I've started my enterprise, like you gentlemen and ladies starting your enterprise, with needing $1 million and in trying to make it up by increasing the number of units of things you sell, which increase the burden on your operation. $1 million of premium is not $1 million in asset. It's $1 million of exposure to additional risk. That means more people are subjected, $1 million worth of losses you're exposing to instead of $500,000 worth of losses. That's the problem here, is we keep increasing the exposure and trying to stopgap it with other things, and we still have started with nothing in the till. And that is the critical issue. The issues raised by the gentleman from Towers Perrin, who has extensive credentials and is a lot similar to mine in many respects, says, well, and I agree with him, that the legislature should encourage competition, not only competition among insurance companies that meet the standards for insurance companies, but should allow innovation. And this is where my experience in helping form the Medical Indemnity Corporation of Alaska back in 1976 is useful to look at, because there was a serious situation, a crisis that needed to be addressed. The insurance industry wouldn't respond, and the physicians needed some sort of response. And the legislature made a response. What was that response? It was form an alternative mechanism, but capitalize it adequately. And those that are around the table that were here then will remember that we required that there be $3 million plus an additional $3 million that was a standby fund in case that was needed, put up by the state of Alaska. Now, I'm not arguing the state should fund this, but what I'm saying is there's got to be a recognition that you've got to start out with money in the till, because the Medical Indemnity Corporation, like any insurance enterprise that starts out, is going to lose money. The startup expenses are great. The losses have to be posted and reserved, even though the premium may not be there that day. And there has to be a cushion for that. And I believe there are others. I believe the director of insurance has done a more intimate financial analysis and can demonstrate how, in fact, there are these front-end costs that are going to cause an invasion of the capital if the capital were there, simply because that's the nature of starting a new insurance enterprise, any enterprise, whether it's an insurance company or a pool or a government risk management mechanism. They all have the same financial characteristics. So this has been the nature of our concern. Now, we have some subsidiary concerns, too. I'm concerned about some of the amendments that have come in as a result of the judiciary bill. There's reference to the fact that this is a homogeneous group. My review of the bill says that provision's been taken out, and now it's any people can come together and form a new group. I don't think that's what was intended, but that's my reading of the bill. This is our primary concern. I have one last concern that I'd like to share with you, and then I will be available for questions, and that is, what is the impact on the marketplace of an enterprise like this? I told you up front that I represent an insurance company. As an insurance company, we always would prefer to see fewer competitors than more. But by and large, that's really not our concern. I mean, I'm not concerned that there are other people coming in and writing insurance, because that happens now, and it's happened in the marketplace in the state of Alaska during the 23 years that I've been here. Carriers have come in, and carriers have left, and carriers have come back, and carriers have left. And it does have an impact on the marketplace that isn't as healthy as it might be, but we live with it. But what happens when you have someone come in the marketplace and they are forced to leave, not because of competitive or because of market-driven issues, but because they're financially unable to stick it out? What that does is it leaves a group of employers in the state having to scramble at a time when they're least able to scramble for new replacement coverage, and probably at a time when the rates are starting to move up and the pressure on the marketplace is stiffer than it is right now. The gentleman from Towers Perrin made an interesting observation, and I'd like to just remind you of it. He pointed out that some of these groups in other states have been successful, and indeed he's correct. They have been successful. And the one he cited and the one I cited to you at a previous hearing in New Mexico are successful because they're incredibly large. They work extremely well when they have large numbers. We don't have those large numbers. But the other thing he said was some of them worked and some of them didn't, but where the ones were successful was when there was, for whatever reason, there was restrictions in the normal marketplace. It was tough to get workers' compensation insurance, so it was natural to kind of move over into a market that could absorb that. In the state of Alaska now, and I expect for well into the near future, we're in a very competitive market. We have a number of people writing, and the prices are moving down rapidly, and the home builders know that. They've seen it in their own rates. This is not a good time to start an enterprise that asks the home builders to expose their net worths to the losses of their competitors, because there are alternatives available that are far less risky, far less expensive, and provide the same adequate protection. With that, I stand open for questions, Mr. Chairman.
Questions from Mr. Block? Senator? Questions? Senator Donnelly?
You mentioned the $1 million, which is much more than the Uniform Act requires. Premium before it starts, but increased exposure. But isn't the whole idea there? It also expands the base and spreads the risk out. I mean, that's what insurance companies do. The more policy you can write, the greater the reduction of your risk, because there's less chance you've spread the risk out over a greater number of clients. So just increasing the exposure isn't necessarily accurate to say that, because the chance that there's some catastrophic event is spread out over a much larger client base.
Part of what you say, Senator Donnelly, is quite correct. The greater the exposure base, then the more you spread it out. But the problem is that you not only look at it in depth, how many people are you covering, but over time, linearly. And we don't know whether that initial major loss that could come around is going to come around on day one or the last day of the policy year. And the problem is that you are living there with this exposure, and there's a greater exposure and thus a greater opportunity for a catastrophic loss because you have more workers covered by the system, and therefore the greater opportunity for there to be an invasion of the capital. This is why, and you can direct more questions to the Director of Insurance, that the law and the regulations affecting insurance companies say the more business you write, and that's not only for a new company, it's for companies that have been existed for numerous years, the more business you write, the more capital you're expected to have. There's supposed to be an ongoing ratio of 1-to-1 or 2-to-1, whatever the division's current views on that are, because even though you've been in existence for a number of years, if you're writing $1 million or $100 million or $1 billion worth of premium, you have to have a commensurate amount of capital, because it's known that the capital gets invaded, even by the best of companies.
So that leads me to my second question. You brought up this capital issue. But as long as there's reinsurance, and the reinsurance is approved by the director, which this bill provides for, I mean, so what? That there's reinsurance, they've got it covered. And the same with the increasing the exposure. I mean, you cover that by having appropriate reinsurance.
Senator Donnelly, you're absolutely correct. If the reinsurance was 100%, in other words, every dollar of exposure was covered by a financially responsible insurance company, it wouldn't make any difference. But that's not the reinsurance that's contemplated here. The reinsurance that's contemplated here is excess insurance, either specific excess or what they call an aggregate excess. And some of the information that I've heard about the excess coverage that they're contemplating getting would be excess of $900,000 of losses for the $1 million premium. What that means is that the reinsurance will not pay a dime until the company, this enterprise, has paid out or has incurred $900,000 of losses. Now, I am told, or it's in this bill, that the loss fund is only $700,000, 70% of the $1 million premium, and that 30% is to go to expenses to run the operation. So you are correct that reinsurance does offer a very significant protection, but only to the extent of the excess at which that reinsurance kicks in. And that's the concern that we have.
Not at all.
And that's the concern that under the bill should be addressed by the Director of the Division of Insurance, because this bill leaves the discretion to the director to require what type of reinsurance. I mean, it leaves it up to the director to make sure that the reinsurance is appropriate.
Senator, there are two responses to that. I agree, basically, that a conscientious and a knowledgeable and a, well, I hate to use the term, but let's say politically insensitive director is probably going to know and do the right thing. But my experience tells me that over the years that I've been in this state, and not just this state, but all states, there are directors of different capabilities and qualities and dedication to their job. And if you allow that kind of latitude as a legislature, you're saying to the person, you decide what's right under the circumstances. If you think they should have $900,000 attach point or a $90,000 attach point, you make that decision. It's our view that that leaves a conscientious director of insurance in a very vulnerable position, because that director is obligated to follow the law. And if it says you must issue a certificate if you comply, and they come in and they provide something that kind of looks like it complies, to what extent does the director is going to take it upon himself or herself to act responsibly if the legislature isn't going to act responsibly and lay down what the guidelines are?
But the director has that same problem with domestic insurance companies, don't they? I mean, domestic insurance companies come and they're required to even have less cash than the premium level that's required by the Uniform Act, or by the, you know, this one goes beyond the Uniform Act, I mean, as far as that.
Senator Donnelly, You know, I'm not sure to what you're referring, but I would have to differ with you. The admitted insurance companies doing business in the state of Alaska, as in most states, have a very specific minimum statutory capital and surplus requirement just to open the doors, irrespective of the amount of premium they're intending to write. Beyond that, the statutes now provide a very specific means for ratcheting up that capital and surplus as the companies grow. And it must be in cash or acceptable investments, and all of that is prescribed in the statute, whereas for this, they are not prescribed. Well, they sort of are, because some of those are incorporated into this bill. But a lot of the other regulatory oversights, which the director has with respect to admitted insurance companies, are excluded from the oversight authority with respect to these enterprises. They are, some of them, such as investments, I believe, are covered, but others are not. Every intimate aspect of an insurance company's operations are regulated, are audited, observed, and controlled by the Division of Insurance in ways that are totally beyond what is provided for in this provision. So we're not saying that everything that we have to do as an insurance company, they should have to do as a self-insured group. There may be some reasons why some of the things that we're required to do because of our broader marketing, they ought not to be required to do because they're working with a confined group. But the ones that have to do with the financial integrity of the enterprise and the minimum capitalization of the enterprise, we think is critical, not because because we want them to operate on an equal footing with us, although we do, but because it's doing the same things that we have learned over years, exposes the enterprise to risk, and they should deal with that risk in a responsible way, and the legislature has already said what is a responsible way as to us. Say the same thing to them.
Any other questions on Mr. Block at this time? Thank you, sir. Appreciate
Thank you very much.
Appreciate your testimony. As everyone has heard, the bell has rung for us several minutes ago. We're due on the floor of the Senate. We will continue the hearing on this bill because we have other testimonies from the Director of Insurance and other interested parties that didn't get a chance to testify today. But the schedule we have between now and Monday, we're not going to get back at it, any hope to get back at it, till at least Monday sometime, and that's an optimistic time. We will be dealing with the ADA bonding bill on Monday, and it depends on how we get through that, because that bill has to be on the Senate floor pretty quick if we're going to move forward on that, since it will be a Senate bill. Tomorrow, we will start at 9 a.m. I understand I understand we're having a session at 10 tomorrow. I'd like to start and get at least an hour in. I'm trying to clean up Senate Bill 350 that I understand they've come to agreement on between the industry and AVA, and all them people have a CS for us. And if they are holding hands on that, maybe we can get that out of here the first hour tomorrow before session. After session, we will have our first hearing on SB 352 right after session, the Anchorage International Revenue Bond Bill, and people will be in town to testify on that. And then at 1 o'clock tomorrow, we will start in on the capital budget bill, and we'll continue on that through the afternoon. I don't intend to go too late tomorrow night. Unless we're awful close, I don't intend to go beyond 6 at the latest, and then we'll start again on Sunday sometime. You guys will be able to tell me tomorrow when you want to start on Sunday on the Capitol bill, depending on how far we get tomorrow afternoon. And that is what the plate is going to look like for tomorrow. And we'll be back to this bill, as I say, hopefully sometime Monday, depending on what Senator Pierce and I have on our agenda for conference committee and a few other things. So with that, we will stand in adjournment until tomorrow morning at 9 a.m.